You're listening to Midori House, first broadcast on the 22nd of September 2017 on Monocle 24. Hello and welcome to Midori House, coming to you live from Studio One here in London. I'm Andrew Muller on today's show.
Clearly, people, businesses and public services should only have to plan for one set of changes in the relationship between the UK and the EU. So during the implementation period, access to one another's markets should continue on current terms, and Britain should also continue to take part in existing security measures.
Britain generously offers to spend an extra 2 years arguing over what Brexit actually means. My guests, Monocle's Tom Edwards, Chiara Ramella and Fernando Augusto Pacheco, will be discussing this and the day's other top stories, including Germany's imminent and commendably predictable election, one Italian newspaper's idea for a good news supplement, and daylight saving. It's more or less that time of year again. But should it be? That's all coming up on Midori House on Monocle 24 right now. So, welcome to Midori House. My guests today are indeed Monocle's Chiara Ramella, Tom Edwards and Fernando Augusto Pacheco. Welcome all. We will start tonight in Florence, which earlier today hosted a speech by UK Prime Minister Theresa May, the location chosen for no discernible reason beyond the fact that it enabled her to riff on a Renaissance motif when discussing the UK's future relationship with the EU. She rather skated over the fact that Florence was also where Girolamo Savonarola encouraged a populist revolt by angry serfs before overplaying his hand and being burned alive by the mob he'd incited. The actually important bit was her offer of a 2-year transition period following the UK's official departure from the EU in 2019. Chiara, first of all, is this the obvious attempt to punt the can down the road that it looked?
I think the only possible answer to that question is yes. I mean, reading this in any other way would be quite difficult. It's becoming quite apparent that the level of indecision and of confusion around all this only calls for a bit of a postponement of anything that this means and understanding what it actually does mean.
It is Tom Edwards, almost like nobody really thought any of this through when this referendum was launched, isn't it? Do we imagine the EU is going to be delighted by the prospect of getting to keep a half-in, half-out UK for an extra 2 years, the possibility of, I guess, keeping the UK entirely at the end of it? Or at this point, do your continental cousins, do you think, just rather wish that you would, as a people, clear off?
Well, no, I think probably the latter. I thought it was quite pointed that Theresa May at one point said, "This is an exciting time for many in Europe too." It's like, not exactly how I would describe it, Theresa, but do go on. It was amazing, an amazing effort at papering over the cracks, and I do wonder whether anyone will indeed read it. I don't think any of the main players were there. I mean, we can talk a bit more about, you mentioned that her chance to riff on the Renaissance. I mean, maybe that's why she went there, or maybe it's only that Florence was one of the few places where, you know, the city father said, "Oh, yeah, okay, we haven't got anything on else, anything else on that day." She couldn't go to Brussels, she couldn't go to Berlin, she couldn't go to Paris, etc., etc., etc. It just underlined for me that sense of whistling into the wind, precisely what you just said, Andrew, which we've talked about on this programme before, this idea that no one in this country really had thought about what would happen if we did leave and still don't really know what to do. And it was a masterpiece in pure wishful thinking. I sort of commend her to a degree on the pure cold-blooded honesty with which she presented this as if she really meant it. I mean, that was impressive as an act almost. And she looked she looked confident. She looked like she would believe what she was saying and that she believed people would believe what she was saying. But it was, I don't know, it's pretty empty from where I was sat.
For this to be the first thing she says in months about it as well. I mean, we've been waiting and waiting and waiting for months. Since March was the last time when she triggered Article 50, really. And this is what we've all been waiting for?
Fernando, I for one, to state my own case, I'm not overwhelmed with sympathy for Theresa May on a number of levels, but she is in a completely impossible position. She was a Remainer, and I don't think there's any particular evidence to suggest that she's changed her mind about that. I suspect she probably thinks that this is a massive, unnecessarily unnecessary rather, an altogether avoidable folly. But she is, of course, beholden not only to the headbanger wing of the Conservative Party, but also to, and it is no small change, the 52% of the British electorate who did vote to leave. How do you think she's doing in terms of just reconciling those positions?
I don't think she's doing very well. I still think she's a very weak prime minister. You know, the speech is trying to say, you know, she's trying to say like she really believed in that. But I just felt it was like delaying very important decisions for another 2 years. And I don't think we learned that some things that we should know. For example, I don't think she was very clear about Europeans in the UK. I mean, which kind of rights will they have or not? I don't know. I felt some uncertainty. And you're right. She has problems in her own cabinet as well. You know, some people might be plotting against her.
People are definitely plotting against her. But I mean, I think the people who are plotting against her, what they can't quite answer themselves is the question of why anybody would want this job at this time. On the subject of EU citizens in the UK, Chiara, she did give a shout out to the 600,000 Italians in the country, of whom you are one.
Yes.
She said, "We want you to stay." Were you encouraged and or reassured by that?
Yes, verbatim, she said, "We value you and we thank you for your contribution to our national life," which, you know, I feel particularly addressed by. No, I think that's what frustrated me the most, because it's all very well and good to say this kind of thing, but then one of the main responses from people who have heard the speech today was there was no actual delineation or direction as to what these terms actually will be. And she's said this almost from the onset, that there will be assurances for EU citizens living in the UK, but these assurances have always remained just this abstract term.
Well, can I just jump in there? Because the line she actually said next, Kiara, after the one you quoted, was, "The guarantee I am giving you on your rights is real." That's what she said.
It almost sounds like a 99p advert.
Yes.
It's like, "I promise you it's real."
Well, mercifully, Fernando, they are so bewildered and confused they have not yet got around to what happens to Brazilians and Australians after Brexit. I think we just keep quiet.
Yes.
hope they forget we're here. Tom, how do you actually think this is going to happen at this point? By which I mean Brexit. I become increasingly less confident that this is actually going to go ahead with every passing day.
I've talked about this before, and there are a few remainers who've said, look, it's going to be such a hassle and so problematic that we could just drift into a situation where it never really happens. I just can't see it. You know, the problem that May or whoever succeeds her, and indeed whoever succeeds, you know, even if we had a different political party that take over at some juncture in the next 2, 4, 5 years, they are going to have to contend with the fact that the public voted the way that it did. And I think we will end up leaving. I think there'll be further compromise. To go back to how you started by talking about kicking the can down the road, I wonder, it was interesting seeing what Michel Barnier had to say about May's speech in the immediate aftermath. He sounded not conciliatory, but slightly more ready to treat it as a proper negotiating opening gambit. And I wonder whether there's just enough detail contained. I mean, we've been slightly derisive, but there was a bit more flesh on the bones. I wonder whether it's just enough to kind of to get the ball rolling. But look, it's not until 2019 that it's triggered. This suggests, and I think the EU are warming to the idea of it being at least 2 years of transitional whatever. So that takes us to what, 2021? You can start to see it's beyond the political lifetime for many, certainly MPs we have here, for others who are leading countries in Europe who themselves may face much more almost existential political issues by then. So
there's pointed out that given the demographics of the Leave vote, to invoke the actuarial brutalities of this, that if there is a second referendum, there's going to be less of them.
Well, and let's not forget, we were told I wasn't personally there, but the British people were told in 1973 that this was forever. And lo and behold, you know, whatever that is, a generation or so later, we went the other way. So it's not inconceivable that we could come out and go back in again.
Well, forever is a long time in politics. Let's now glide seamlessly, however, from the most fractious member of the EU, i.e. this one, to its most reliable. Germany votes in a federal election on Sunday, and barring some inadmissibly unlikely mishap, the upshot will be that Chancellor Angela Merkel is returned to office for a fourth term, further reinforcing Germany's stature as the most reassuringly tedious political arena in the Western Hemisphere, and Merkel's status as the de facto leader of the free world, the present occupant of the office which usually holds that title presently being somewhat distracted in citing Armageddon on Twitter. Chiara, as speaking on behalf of the entire continent of Europe at this table, why hasn't Germany gone all weird and mad like everywhere else?
I think it's got to do with timing as well. I think when Donald Trump won the elections, it was straight after the Brexit vote, and it did feel like there was a bit of a wave of things happening all at once. And I think once the dust has settled and that the opportunity of extreme change in elections and voting didn't seem quite that appealing a prospect anymore, then suddenly people kind of went back to this feeling of security. And there are... It was an unstable moment in politics back then. It is obviously even perhaps even more so right now, and I think people appreciate this value of security. I mean, I will forever bring comparisons back to my own home country, which is Italy. I've recently read a survey, a poll of appreciation for our Prime Minister Gentiloni, who is perhaps a very much less charismatic version of what Renzi could ever be. But actually, his approval ratings as Prime Minister are really high. Many people don't actually approve of him as the potential leader of the party in the next election, so they wouldn't want to see him in the primaries because they don't think he's charismatic enough. But this feeling of calmness, of security, actually is very much appreciated in somebody who is in government. And I think Merkel is banking on that.
See, I'm a big fan for now of boring politics. I think it is a condition and a quality to which politicians should aspire. And I just, you come from a country, obviously Brazil, whose politics you could characterise as quite interesting at the moment. Very much too interesting. Do people, and I guess, you know, Trump, you could argue, represents the apotheosis of this mistake. People do expect to be entertained by politics at some level, and I'm not sure that's healthy.
Well, but at the same time, you know, I do, to be honest, you know, I prefer the mode of Germany when politics are a bit boring. But to be honest, there are also a few problems in Germany as well. I think, especially if you're like a center-left voter, in a way, she ate the Social Democrats in a way, especially with those grand coalitions. The party is so weak at the moment, and that made ways for the Alternative for Germany, the far right, to gain traces. So, okay, you know, Germany's in a good state economically. But, you know, maybe politics, you know, shouldn't be as well that boring. You know, I'm not saying you should entertain people like Trump does, but there are problems as well, even in German politics, in my opinion.
Tom, as Fernando points out, Alternative for Deutschland are carrying the interesting flag into the German election, and that is a charitable way of describing them. How worrisome would any sort of substantial showing from them be? Because if they do come up with 15 or 16%, they will return a fairly hefty contingent to Germany's parliament. But is... how to put it tactfully, does Germany's history place an upper limit on how far extremism can go in modern Germany?
I think that it does. I think the worry for me is less about the absolute success of Alternative for Deutschland, and I doubt they'll get to the mid-teens, as you say there, but perhaps maybe around 10, 11. That's what the polling...
At the risk of undermining my hard-won reputation for impartiality, I'm going to go ahead and say I hope they do quite badly.
No, I agree with you. I think what's instructive, though, is to look at from whence they have derived their support. It's not just come from frustrated centre-right voters. And I think this speaks to what Fernando's saying, which is that if you have an electorate who are maybe a little, you know, they're suffering from ennui with the political process. It's too stable. It's become, you know, they're sort of stupefied
by the fact
that
ennui?
That there's no change.
Which is actually one of the few things the Germans don't have a word for.
Well, and it's the AfD have derived support from the... Well, almost from the extreme left, from the centre left, from the centre ground, the centre right, and you know the less extreme right, and that's the thing about their performance that worries me. And you see it across the board in regional election performances as well. I'm less worried about their absolute contribution to the process, but you know I sort of agree with what everyone said. Merkel it feels like a sort of bulwark against a lot of this change. You know, I think of her alongside politicians who, if you look at other countries in Western Europe, politicians who seem like something from a bygone era. You know, remember her talking to Tony Blair or her counterparts at, in that era in France or wherever. And now she just seems to have been left alone. And it's the same on the EU stage. She seems to be the last embodiment of that, a more positive story for the EU. It's so embattled. There's so many questions about the bloc existentially. I sort of worry a bit whether she can retain her own enthusiasm for the job it seems she's certain to carry on doing for a while yet, at least.
Kiara, is the rest of the European continent, again, you know, you need only the merest grasp of 20th century history to understand why people are a bit awkward about it, but is the European continent at this point resigned to German leadership as an idea?
I think it has. And I think, in a way, as much as Tom says, Merkel may have herself perhaps lost steam in her embodying the ideal of the EU at this point, because she has become this beacon of unity in a way. I think perhaps the fact that she resists for the fourth, she may well resist for the fourth term. Also, I also see it in a way as a symbol of the fact that the EU, because I think for me and for many people around the Europe, she has become the symbol of the EU, that it still holds sway despite all the winds of change, perhaps.
She is mutty to us all, Andrew, for now.
Don't
at
you
least.
Feel it?
We will take a short break now. You're listening to Midori House with me, Andrew Miller, along with Chiara Ramella, Fernando Augusto Pacheco and Tom Edwards. Coming up next, good news for good news.
Monocle has bureau around the world. In Tokyo, Hong Kong, Singapore, London, Toronto and New York City. In Tokyo, our bureau chief is Fiona Wilson.
There's something about Tokyo. Once you're here and you live here, it gets more and more interesting. It's such a big city, but I think also it's just one of these very layered cities. Most months, actually most weeks, there's something new to keep us interested. You know, either it's a new development or a, you know, really interesting new building, a new fashion brand, something going on.
Hear from Monocle's editors and correspondents on the stories that matter and the places that matter every day on Monocle 24.
You're back with Midori House with me, Andrew Muller. Still with me are Chiara Ramella, Tom Edwards and Fernando Augusto Pacheco. Now, it has almost always been the case that news, which is to say what is on the news, is bad news, at least for whoever the news is about. On most running orders, wars, disasters and scandals will outrank improvements, breakthroughs, kittens being retrieved safely from up trees or down wells and so forth. Italian newspaper Corriere della Sera, in fact. It is Sarah, isn't it? Yes, it is. Plans to take kind of a flight in the face of this wisdom by launching on Tuesdays a weekly supplement of good news. Chiara, it seems only fair to put this to you as a spokesperson for the entire Italian nation. Why are they doing this? Do we like this idea?
I think we like the idea that it's about good news, because if you had read the headlines in Italy over the past few years, and in general the media discourse over the past few years has consistently been so very negative. And I say this on top of what, you know, news normally is about, and we're all aware as journalists of the fact that bad news creates a bit of a glitch in a system, therefore is worthy of being reported. But I think overall the mood has been so dreary over the past few years in Italy that a change of discourse may just be a welcome thing.
There is a thing here, though, isn't there, Tom? And I even speaking as somebody who's, you know, spent my entire professional career being a journalist, I'm always aware of the fact that the news is not really what the world is like. Because by definition, everything on the news is unusual and exceptional. What you never see on the news is, and in your city or country today, people just sort of got up, went to work, got on with things, spent a bit of time with friends and family. Things generally work, clean water comes out of the taps, it's great to be alive.
Well, no, and this used to happen, in fact. People in this country famously point back to an old, very old BBC or World Service broadcast where the sort of avuncular gentleman came on and said, nothing really happened today, now time for some music, and just played some gentle tunes for people. people. And I think, in a sense, that's what Corriere della Sera is delivering here, which is good news. It is the contemporary print equivalent of some soft music. But also, it's a little more than that. It's not just good news. If you look at the brief, they're talking about volunteering. They're talking about sectors which are sort of change-driven, foundations, cooperatives, schools, and messages of positivity. But they're also trying to encourage some spark and discussion even amongst people, this protagonists does, in those sectors.
This which does I sound think is like positive. It sounds quite a lot like Monocle magazine. Do we need to crush them like bugs?
Oh no, but I think that what is interesting is Monocle has never shied away from confronting challenging stories or difficult situations. But we've always tried to invest the stories that we've told on paper and indeed on the radio with something positive. It doesn't mean you're burying your head in the sand. It means you're looking at the world as in a constructive way, in a proactive way. And I think people, if they need a specific dedicated supplement to help them do it, then all the better.
And may I say, you know, as a reader, I do like reading actually positive stories. You know, I'm not sure if the public agree with me, but for example, like, let's choose my own country. I mean, which is, we're having a terrible year in terms of branding. But, you know, for example, I read a recent article how the shoe industry in Brazil is doing so well, is employing a lot of people. I know it's very specific, but I like to know the positive light, even in the most war-torn countries or, you know, countries that are suffering economic decline. You know, we need this kind of solutions, you know, not only just pointing the problem in a way. I like to read about that as well.
Chiara, is it possible, and I may not have thought this one all the way through, that this is an attempt by the print media to respond to what is called online clickbait, and that those often are good news stories about, you know, cuddly animals or people doing something nice for somebody else and so forth. And they do often go massively, massively viral, which does seem to suggest that there is an appetite for those stories. Can they work in a weekly newspaper supplement as well?
Well, I think it's interesting that they've decided to launch this as a weekly supplement on a Tuesday as well, which is not normally a kind of a Sunday supplement kind of day where you have time to pore over these stories. So there's got to be something about the fact that they've decided to invest in print with this and to have this as one of their main three supplements, essentially, throughout the week. Perhaps it's the medium. It's a way of trying to find some content that would relaunch a bit of the print.
It is an unsung day, Tuesday. Actually, literally, I don't have the facts in front of me. I would be willing to wager £5 that there are fewer songs written about Tuesday than any other.
Well, I was going to say, is it fair to say, Andrew, you're not exactly a morning person. Are you a Tuesday person?
I'm just trying to think. There was Tuesday Morning by the Pogues. There's a song called Tuesday by the Hummingbirds. Beyond that, I am Ruby Tuesday, of course. By the way, actually, there might be more. How many Thursday songs are there?
We are deviating
from the point somewhat.
I absolutely hate Tuesdays. I think it's the worst. For me, it's the worst day of the week because Monday for me is the beginning of something new. You know, it could be an excellent week. You know, there's a sense of hope, which
it's always
Tuesday evaporates.
By Tuesday, it's gone.
It's gone. And then Wednesday's close to the weekend. So.
Wednesday's close to the weekend. What are you doing on Thursdays and Fridays?
Well, I'm going to be looking into this. The rest of the HR department.
we're learning a lot about Fernando's work practices here. So basically by Tuesday afternoon, you're pretty much phoning it in, really. It's just like, yep, another week of broken hopes and crushed dreams. Why do I bother?
Not after reading Buena Notizia.
Exactly. It's made to pick up the early afternoon, the early afternoon, kind of early week slump, you know? It's the week equivalent of the 3 p.m.
Those famous Tuesday blues. I can't think of a single song about Thursdays now that I think of it.
Tune in next week. We'll have more on this.
We are going to move along slightly and finally tonight because we are approaching that time of year at which countries which have put their clocks forward an hour put them back and vice versa, although possibly not for that much longer in Brazil, where President Michel Temer intends to conduct an online poll, because those are always reliable, of the merits of ending it. Brazil has observed daylight saving time since 1985. Fernando, what is this the kind of thing you do when your government is absolutely up to its neck in ruinous scandals? Is this basically President Michel Temer going, look, over there, a squirrel or something?
No, and to top it all, he wants to kill my lovely daylight saving, you know, because
I thought that sentence was going to end in a different way there for a second.
Brazilians are divided, actually, on that topic. There was a poll actually of, by, again, you say online polls, they're not reliable, but the newspaper Globo said, do you want the daylight savings to continue or not? I think 52% said they don't want daylight savings. I was very surprised. But 48%, it was like almost the Brexit vote there. But, you know, and the reason why they're doing that, because originally it was introduced to save, you know, of course, energy consumption, but it's not saving lots of money, actually, because the Brazilians are using a lot of air conditioning. I think that's the main reason. But I find it personally quite sad.
What's the Italian view on this? Do you do daylight saving in Italy?
Yes. However, I am not very representative of the whole Italian population because yeah, exactly. always a token Italian in each. Daylight saving always takes me by surprise. This is a very personal confession, but I always constantly lose track of when it's going to happen. And then I always happen to be on some sort of night bus in London. And then I always feel like I've got stuck in a time warp where I've been out for hours and hours and end, but it's always 2 a.m. in the morning.
So your view of daylight saving is that it should be abolished because you personally find it inconvenient and disorienting?
I think that probably would hold sway, yes.
I'd go one step further. For me, the whole thing is a sort of massive chronological inconvenience. I don't mind if people choose GMT or BST, as it would be here, or whatever the regional variant would be. But I think you need to just stick with one. It's a bit like the origin stories are important. Fernando mentions there it's about economies of energy consumption, this sort of thing. Again, a lot of these things in this country was about productivity during wartime. There's always some specious story about the safety of children walking to school in the Highlands of Scotland during the long winter months. I'm just not buying it. Everything's moved on. I think that we need to choose one and leave it. It constantly troubles me that I never quite know what's going on because there's grades of it as well. They change at different places at different times.
There is a terrifically annoying couple of weeks in which America and the UK are on different. Which I mean, it disproportionately annoys people who have to write time checks at the top of radio programs. So again, this is a niche complaint.
But isn't there a time, Fernando? Am I right in saying is it 2 or 3 hours? We get terribly close from London to Rio, is that right?
Sometimes it's 2, 3, 4 hours. It's very confusing.
Why, 2 hours? How is that possible?
Are you worried they're catching us up?
Well, I don't know.
No, and I have to say, you know who is going to be happy with this decision? Because I didn't tell you guys, but the north region of the country, they'd never change the time. So there's some kind of inconveniences. So, for example, the soap opera at 9 p.m. So basically, they watch the soap at 8. But at 8, you can't show certain scenes with violence or sex or something. So they have a censored version of the soap opera. So now they will be able to watch the
So they
full
want on. To abolish daylight saving so they can watch more sex and violence in their telenovelas.
Exactly.
Because we have a similar situation at home in Australia, where Queensland, despite being on the same longitude as New South Wales and Victoria, refuses to observe daylight saving. So there is a period at which Queensland, despite being on the same longitude, is in fact 1 hour behind. The standard joke being that the Queenslanders reject daylight saving because they think the extra hour of sunshine fades their curtains.
I think the important thing to bear in mind is there's plenty of examples where nations, whole blocks of nations indeed, have unilaterally decided to change things like time zones, like their summertime and so forth. So I think you have adjacent islands, is it in the South Pacific, where it's quite literally the next day, even though they're only a handful of miles apart, and you know, the world doesn't stop spinning on its axis. We managed to get by. So I think it's high time. Pick one and stick with it.
I think in the UK it should be on daylight saving all year round, which means I realise that it will be very, very dark in the mornings during winter, but as I'm rarely awake at that time, I couldn't personally care less. Just quickly round the table, of course, when we put the clocks back, which I think it's either this weekend or next weekend or at some point in the near future, I'm sure Chiara we get that extra hour. I plan to spend mine seeing if I can figure out how to change the time on my microwave oven. The rest of you?
That normally ends with me heaving aforementioned microwave oven out the window into the garden in pure anger. Oh, well, I can never know. You gain an hour in the morning, you lose one in the evening. It starts to get dark at 2 p.m. I just find it depressing.
I'm not a morning. I'm like you, Andrew. Also, I do like the sunshine late in the afternoon, because here in the UK at 4 p.m. it's very depressing when it gets dark. I'm like, no. I mean, you leave work and it's very depressing.
The idea of having more light in the morning only makes me feel more guilty about not going for runs. I think it's intended to entice you into making the most of the morning, which I just cannot seem to bring myself to do.
So ideally you'd like the clock to be changed so it's 2 o'clock in the afternoon more or less permanently?
Probably, although I'd prefer aperitivo time, so around 5 p.m. roughly.
Probably post-Brexit, that's probably
This will be literally the somewhere where it is 5 o'clock, always. And that does bring us to the end of today's show. Fernando Augusto Pacheco, Chiara Miller and Tom Edwards, thanks for joining us at Midori House. The show was produced by Ben Ryland, researched by Fernando and Maddie Speed. More music next at 1900. What is tonight's The Menu, I think, on Fridays, isn't it? With Marcus Hippie. More on the day's main stories on The Daily at 2200. Midori House returns on Monday at the same time, 1800 London. For now, I'm Andrew Miller. Thanks for listening.